We'd like to thank VideoBlocks.com for sponsoring this episode. Stick around to learn about some amazing offers available to you for being a listener of Not Alone. We are also brought to you through the unfailing support of our patrons over at Patreon.com. These donations help us to keep the lights on every month and allow us to access the materials we need to bring you the highest caliber of show that we can, which is, of course, what you, our listeners, deserve. Now, to learn more about supporting your favorite show, head over to patreon.com/notalonepodcast. Thank you so much to everyone who helps make this possible week after week. Now, let's get on with the show. Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And this week we are finishing up our two-part series on the zombification of Clavius Narcisse.
Oh yeah.
Getting jiggy with it?
I was thinking like spooky and then boogie like came in my mind. Okay. And then I don't know. Isn't there like a zombie song or dance thing?
They don't dance. They kind of just shamble.
The shuffle?
Yeah.
That's great. All right. Sam, again, not a visual medium.
So, I think we're really just going to get right into it today. I can't think of any announcements or anything.
Yeah. So, last week, we covered what part of this?
We started with, remember, guys, it's a two-parter. So, yeah. If you haven't heard part one, go back and listen.
You might get a little lost here. Yes.
So, we started with the story of Clavius Narcisse, right? He's dead, and then he's dug up, he's alive again, and he's a slave for 2 years.
Oh, okay.
Kind of. He's a slave, he comes home after 18 years, all that. Then we transitioned in, we talked about Wade Davis, the ethnobotanist, who is on the trail for zombie poison, trying to figure out how this happened. And then we ended it right after we talked about voodoo. We kind of gave I'm sure it was terribly simplistic, but a simplified brief overview of voodoo and a voodoo ceremony, and that's where we left it. Okay, so we're gonna pick up right after this voodoo ceremony.
Okay, right. And so are we talking about like how you get the job done?
We're talking about the actual poison itself. We're talking about some of the more social implications. We're talking about Davis's conclusions. And then the world's conclusions about Davis. So
wonderful. All right. Yep. Where are we starting off then?
We are starting off after witnessing this ceremony. As we mentioned last week, Davis came away convinced that the power of voodoo, in addition to potentially having a pharmacological component, was also the power of the mind. He had his own ideas about the psychological power of belief and the role that this plays in those ceremonies and in voodoo in large. But beyond that, he knows that the reason that he's down in Haiti is to find this substance, this pharmacological substance that can turn a man into the living dead.
It's all about them drugs.
Exactly. I did so much research on different kinds of drugs this week.
Did you?
Yes. It was awesome. After his experience with Max Beauvoir, Davis sought to track down the second name on his list that had been given to him by the BBC.
Just as a recap, Max Beauvoir is he's essentially the voodoo's spiritual leader.
Yes. He's the Hungen. He's the good voodoo priest, essentially. He's the light side, although this is a false equivalency. So,
okay, I'm done.
No spoilers, Jason. So, Davis sought to track down the second name on his list. That of a supposed Bokor, or the kind of dark side of the faith, the sorcerer who had...
The yin to his yang.
Yes, the sorcerer who had intimate knowledge of the zombification process, who had provided other scientists and reporters with samples of his alleged zombie poison. His name was Marcel Pierre.
So, hold on one second.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't zombie powder, like, really coveted stuff? Why is this guy just giving it out to other people?
So...
Like, isn't it like a really traditional thing?
It's, you know? We're going to get into why in a minute, why he's not that worried. But you also have to remember that the BBC, as well as Wade Davis, are backed by some very wealthy people.
That's fair.
And money talks, you know. Money talks, people walk. I don't know how that saying goes. Something like that. So beyond that, as we'll see, there are different components to the zombie poison beyond just the powder itself, mm-hmm. that maybe makes Marcel believe that what he gave the BBC would have been inert anyway. So, and we'll get into that. But Pierre, he owns a bar, which is called the Eagle Bar. And Wade Davis visits this accompanied by the daughter of Max Beauvoir named Rachel. She, like, is with him the entire book. She's his translator and his guide. They told Pierre that Davis would pay him handsomely for a sample of his zombie poison. Now, they were taken into the temple that Pierre had fashioned around the back of the bar, and from within his altar, which was decorated with the image of Catholic saints juxtaposed by human skulls, he took out a powder and offered it to Davis. But Davis said, no, I need to see the powder made. Otherwise, it's not worth anything to me. I need to know all of the ingredients. So for a sum of money that Davis would only call substantial, Pierre agreed, and the next day they went about gathering ingredients, which mainly consisted of, like, various types of leaves. And then they went to the magic shop, the apothecary, and they bought these little powders. And then they tried to go digging for human bones.
I'm certain the powders were named something kind of whimsical.
Then they're amazing. One of them is named, like, Respect the Crossroads. Another one is just named Black Magic. It's awesome. and he's...
You could just buy Black Magic. Huh? You could just buy powder it. Or liquid?
It's, they're powders. And they're all powders. Okay. They're, like, basically colored talcum powder.
Ah, gotcha. So yeah. It's really concentrated stuff.
It's completely inert. It's completely useless in the long end of things. They tried to go dig up human bones, and they weren't denied on the basis of common decency. They were denied because they didn't have their permits in order. So he says, okay.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. So the Haitian government.
I guess you can get a permit
get
to
a permit
dig up bones.
To dig up human remains.
Which, seeing as how bones play, so even with the not bad side of voodoo, just as part of voodoo in general,
yeah,
bones play a part in it. And so I guess that makes it a little sense. Yeah, it's not anything like the States here where the minute that you get close to a grave, you're desecrating it and going to jail and all that. So,
okay.
I just want to be a grave robber.
I feel like it's really not that. That's a lot of work to put in for probably very little gain, if any.
Especially these days. We don't really bury people with nice things anymore.
No.
I wonder if that's like a commentary on how the materialism of the world is like. We can't even let the dead have their nice things.
Well, I think it's we keep them like, for ourselves. You know, sentimentary.
I guess so. That's
I mean,
true
that's
too.
Why I have my grandmother's ring.
Well, if I die before Baron, if I die before Baron, I want you to do it the Egyptian way and bury him with me. Okay.
Oh my God.
You'd like that, wouldn't you? Gonna hang out with you.
That's
Dan.
Awful.
Anyway,
and if I pass before you, Tibetan sky burial.
Yeah, right. Homie, I got that.
Spread myself to the winds.
So yeah, they're denied being able to dig for bones because of lack of permit. But they get pretty much everything else. And the bones, Marcel says, I've got mountains of bones at home. It's fine.
Cool. That's not a red flag.
Yeah. Now, Davis, of course, is a trained botanist, and he realizes that none of the ingredients that they're collecting have even a hint of toxicity to them.
Yeah, they're going to be duds.
Yeah, they would be completely unable to produce the type of reaction that Clavius and others had reported. Regardless, once all was said and done, he still paid the sum. He took the powder to be analyzed, and he says, while he was sure that the powder was entirely worthless, he was also convinced that Pierre did know the actual recipe and that he could get it out of him somehow. So this is why Pierre had no problem giving it to the BBC, because he just has a fake powder he gives to...
So he scammed him.
Yeah, he scams him.
Okay.
He scams everybody. He's a scammer. But he's a pretty neat guy. Good guy.
He's a scammer. But he's cool.
He's all right. So as this powder is being analyzed, again, he pretty much knows what it's going to say, but lets it go do its thing.
As, yeah, maybe there's some weird chemical thing that happens between the...
Some weird interaction, the
plants.
Yeah. As this is going on, Davis then goes on and spends some time at the neurological and psychological center with Dr. Duyon. And if you'll remember from last week, Dr. Duyon originally brought the case of Clavius Narcisse to the attention of the Americans. He's the one who at this point had been studying zombies for 20-odd years. And Davis was more than a little discouraged by this meeting. He basically says, well, Duyon's been studying this for 20 years and has absolutely nothing to show for it.
Right. Like, how am I going to get lucky?
Yeah. Yeah. And he's a local, he's a native, he knows people. Duyon has, well, again, he also agrees that there's a pharmacological component. He is much, much, much more interested in the social, psychological side and all of that. So while he's tried to find the zombie poison, it hasn't really been a priority for him like it is for Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he finally did gain something out of this because through this meeting, he actually came face-to-face with Clavius Narcisse. Now, Narcisse repeated pretty much the exact same story to Wade. He dies. He's dug out of the ground. He's set to work at a plantation. One of his fellow zombies kills the plantation owner. He goes home after his brother died. All that. But he did add a little bit to it. The first is that he pointed out a scar on his cheek, which he showed to Davis, and it was a sharp, short gash. Clavius claimed that it was from a nail striking him as his coffin was assembled. What do you think?
How do they build coffins over there that it hit him in the head?
Well, just that he's in there, and they're nailing the coffin on.
Right.
And then he gets hit with a nail in the face.
Okay.
Sometimes you take a nail to the face, Jason.
So, Sam, aren't coffins constructed like so?
I wouldn't be surprised if over there it's more of just like a box.
That's even farther away from your face then.
Not if it's a really narrow little box.
Sam, it has to be over his shoulders, Sam.
Right.
Your head is not as big as your shoulders. At least it shouldn't be. Otherwise...
Why is it that out of everything, this is the detail you're sticking on?
Because details matter.
Not the, I was dead and I was raised and now I am a zombie.
Oh, my opinion's already been made on that. That's why.
All right. Anyway, I'm just telling it like it is. He claims that there is a scar on his cheek from where a nail hit him.
I just think that sounds weird. That's all. That's all I'm saying. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Thank you, Jason. Now, the second piece of evidence or second thing that Clavius has to say is that after his body was put in the ground, he claimed that his consciousness left his body and floated above it. This corresponds to the traditional Haitian belief that a short time after death, the soul will actually separate from the body, and then it stays separated, and then it comes back together and it's fused again. It's during this time in Haitian culture that you are at risk for becoming a zombie. It's at this time that the Bokor can trap your soul one way or the other. He also gave more detail about the actual being risen from the grave itself. We might think of it as being quiet, shadowy work. You know, somebody comes in the dead of night and tries to make as little noise as possible and opens the coffin. But in reality,
it's a lot more direct.
Well, and a lot more dramatic. The ceremony is performed brazenly. He, you know, the Bokor does not care if anybody sees or hears him. He's sure that somebody is going to anyway. And it has to do with the loud banging of drums and fire and chanting. And they pull him out of the ground and they say something along the lines of like, Clavius Narcisse, Clavius Narcisse, Clavius Narcisse, come forth! And then they open the coffin.
All right, I like the show.
It's super dramatic. It sounds awesome if it wasn't like the most terrible thing I've ever heard in my life. But it just, again, further solidifies in Davis's belief that this is a totally accepted part of society. Nobody is running to stop him, even when there are drums coming out of the graveyard at midnight. You know, that's not very discreet at all. Now, another individual was also presented to Davis during this meeting as well. This one was a woman who is known as T-Femme, which means little woman. Her name, her given name was Francina Ilias. Francina Ilias. Now, she was another well-known zombie who had been taken under Duyon's care, and she had supposedly died in 1976, only to reappear 3 years later in the marketplace near to her home. Now, unlike Narcisse, T-Femme was substantially affected in the long term by her experience. She had almost no memory of the last 3 years. She had difficulty walking and speaking. She just wasn't all there, and her grave was exhumed and found to be full of rocks, as was typical practice in the cases of zombification. However,
is there a significance to the rocks, or is it just like adding weight back into the box?
Yeah, just adding weight back to the box. Yeah. However, Clairvius's grave was never exhumed, and the reason for that is where T-Femme could hardly function. This individual, in the opinion of the people who found her and Dr. Duyon, could not construct a conspiracy or a plot or a big to-do about her coming back, whereas Narcisse was all there. He for the most part, he spoke a little slowly, but other than that, his mental capacities were still there. So T-Femme probably couldn't have dug up the grave herself and put in rocks or instructed anybody to do it. Clairvius totally could have. So they figure if they dig up Clairvius's grave and there's bones in it, there's no way to prove that that's Clairvius Narcisse. They don't have DNA fingerprinting at this time.
What about dental?
I don't think they have dental records. Okay. He was a peasant. I don't know that he had access to good dental care.
That's fair. Okay.
And then if they opened it and it was empty, well, cool. He's a zombie, but they also could have just taken out the body and thrown it away, right? So...
Or now, use it for other potions and powers.
Right, which as they do. Now, T-Femme, though, she was permanently mentally damaged by her experience. She, like Narcisse, was rejected by her family, and a few missionaries found her living on the streets and took her to Dr. Duyon's center. Now, there are a lot of different theories about T-Femme, just like there are a few different theories about Narcisse. However, T-Femme's... again, is a little more murky. She can't speak for herself. She never, to the day she died, never said what happened to her or why. But the idea, the more commonly held idea, especially by Duyon, was that her mother had arranged a marriage for her between her and a Bokor. Duyon says, okay, well, obviously she rebelled, and she said, I don't want to marry this Bokor. And then the Bokor turned her into a zombie and married her anyway. And there were rumors. Aww. Yeah. Gross.
Depressing.
Yeah. There were rumors that her body had signs of having gone through childbirth, even though she didn't have a child before she died. So take that as it will. Disgusting.
So, I mean, I don't really want to go this direction, but how much do you think it is just incredibly hardcore drug abuse? More like forced drug abuse.
So that is kind of the...
Of one sort or another, whether it be a poisoning or, you know, something else.
Are we talking about T-Femme specifically? Or just zombies in general?
Kind of both. T-Femme for the specific example here, because of, we're talking about, you know, a mental degradation and a physically weakened form.
Right, which is part of it. That's how... essentially the zombie should come out. That is I hate to say it, but that is a perfectly prepared zombie where their time in the coffin causes brain damage because of lack of oxygen. And then a long-term steady diet of drugs wrecks the rest of their mind essentially so that they're vacant. Narcisse is an outlier in that respect.
Right.
So yes, I guess.
Okay.
Now I'm not talking like heroin though. I'm not saying like heroin or cocaine or anything like
that. Oh, no. I'm talking more like mushrooms, if anything, or something toxic.
Well, we'll get into, we've got that as far as the actual what they use to keep them as zombies. We'll
right.
get into that. And it's definitely hallucinogenic stuff, stuff like that. It's not mushrooms. I don't know how well that would go down. That'd be scary. But yeah, no, there's definitely an element of drug use to it. That's the idea itself. But T-Femme, like I said, she is the perfectly prepared zombie. She is the ideal zombie, whereas Clavius still retains
so depressing.
Part of him. I know,
right?
It's
yeah.
so sad. But the other counter argument here is that the people who present themselves as zombies, for the most part, beyond Clavius, Narcisse, even potentially T-Femme, these people are actually just individuals who have cognitive disabilities and are instead assigned these identities, right? So mm-hmm. T-Femme couldn't identify herself. Her mother identified her. So the idea would there be then that T-Femme actually did die, never came out of the grave. Forget about the fact that her coffin is full of rocks. This is just the idea.
Okay.
She's still dead somewhere. But this individual who has a cognitive disability shows up, can't identify herself, can't really interact. And T-Femme's mother, full of grief, says, "That's her. That's my girl. She's
right.
a zombie," and all of that. Now, where that doesn't add up is that the reuniting with the family is never sentimental and nice and wonderful.
Right. It's always, it's if anything, more like another stab. It's another
yeah.
wound.
It's the worst thing that can happen to the family themselves is for their loved one to come back as a zombie. Because suddenly everyone's thrown under suspicion. Everybody is...
Right. And again, zombification is a punishment.
Yeah, exactly.
You have done something bad, and then I'm sure it's probably disgraceful for the rest of the family as well, knowing
exactly.
that you've got a zombie in your ranks.
Yes, 100%. And what we also see is that it goes even beyond, you know, here in the United States, we have our mandatory minimum sentences, and we try to have a very even system of government where the same crime, theoretically, the same crime gets the same punishment over and over and over. Whereas there are so many different elements of that justice system in Haiti, especially in regards to these secret societies and the zombification, which we're going to get into in just a moment here after this section. But before we do, it's worth noting that Clavius did volunteer even more experience about his own, or even more information about his own experience as well. He took Davis to the graveyard that he had been buried in, and he pointed out his grave. And he told Davis how his brother had sold him to a Bokor named Joseph Jean. And Davis pressed him, asking how the poison that killed him had been administrated and how... what did it look like and feel like? And Narcisse says, "There's no poison at all. The Bokor trapped my soul in a ceremony that was done using a basin where water is transformed into human blood through magic. Once he had been uncovered and taken out of the ground, he was taken before a tribunal and he was judged for 8 days until his fate was finally decided on. And he claimed as well that after the Bokor was killed, he tried to write to his family, but they never answered him. When he returned to town, he was so poorly received by the authorities, or he was so poorly received that the authorities were worried for his well-being, and they put him in jail for safekeeping before transferring him to Duyon's facility. His family only told him to leave. One of his sisters offered him money to get the heck out of there, and it's in this cemetery, as he's recounting all of this to Davis, that he says the best line in this entire series. They ask, who did this? You know, who zombified you originally? Who was at this tribunal? Who condemned you? All of this. Davis and Rachel just kept pressing him over and over. And then he says, they are the masters of the land. They do as they please. Isn't that hardcore?
I'm not going to lie. I was expecting a little bit more of
what? I think that's
you built it up
hardcore.
Pretty well. You built it up.
Thank you. Thank
too
you.
Much. And it blew my expectations.
I'm sorry then. I apologize. They're
way too strong.
Who's too strong? What?
My expectations.
Oh, okay. I thought
they
you
were great.
Like the zombies? The zombies are too strong?
No, they're pretty weak.
That's fair.
They're weak and malnutrition, malnourished.
All right. So, as we mentioned, though, a moment ago, there's more to it than just what meets the eye in this case. You'll notice that Clavius's account makes it sound like he really didn't do anything too wrong. He fought with his brother, but who hasn't fought with his brother? Yeah, you know, we all quarrel. And, you know, T-Fem, she...
Fought with my brother yesterday.
Right? She was
how
very...
How we say hello.
She was very noble, and she was very, no, I won't marry this man that I don't love, mother. I have to live my own life. Very noble, very...
Why does she sound...
I don't know. It's because it's... The point is that these stories, especially the ones that Duyan and Narcisse construct, are very noble and very, oh, woe is me, and I'm a poor, unfortunate soul. But as we've mentioned about 25,000 times now, zombification is a punishment. It's a social check and balance. So there's something about this that doesn't necessarily jive to Davis, you know? So they decide, okay, we're going to go looking. Davis and Rachel, they go to T-Fem's village, and they actually meet a powerful Mambo there who owns a bar. All of these, not all of them, but a lot of these, the Mambo, it's the female, it's the priestess.
Okay, okay, I'm following.
It's not Mambo number 5. Don't do this.
I'm glad you knew where I was going.
So, and these Mambos, these Hungans, and these Bokors, they own, a lot of times they own like bars, which I suppose is just a byproduct of being a staple of the society. Your home is automatically a meeting place, so why not turn it into a business and this and that? But they do. They go to a bar of one of the most powerful Mambos in the area.
Huh. They drink spirits and then they communicate with spirits.
And then they communicate with spirits. And this Mambo has a lot to say about T-Fem. She says that T-Fem had a reputation within the community for being dishonest and untrustworthy. If you went into the market to buy something from her, she'd say, okay, it costs this much, and then you would barter with her, and then she'd agree to, you know, 5 whatever. And then when she wrapped it up and handed it to you, she'd say, okay, it's 6. You're gonna pay me 6 for this. And it just deal dishonestly. She would just openly steal from market stalls. If anyone left any money unattended, she grabbed it immediately. People really, really hated her. And the Mambo said that they couldn't afford not to kill her.
Okay, so she was causing social stress on other merchants.
Exactly. She
and outright hurting the economy that way.
Exactly. She was terrible for the market. So according to this Mambo, they kind of all tripped in together and they got her zombified. Like a terrible, terrible gift. Now,
oh man. Okay.
Right. Now, as they are looking, they find this about T-Fem, and the only person who says anything different about T-Fem is her mother. Her mother says she was a beautiful, perfect angel and
yeah,
never did anything. Of course she did. Not
we
even,
all are beautiful, perfect angels to our mothers.
Well,
I think the big thing.
It's true. But not even necessarily from that like motherly point of view, but I really do believe that the reason she did that is because she didn't want to deal with the shame and the stigma of
having your daughter's a zombie.
Yeah, it's not a great thing to happen for your self-image. But from there, the Mambo hated her. Everyone that they talked to hated her, just her mother didn't. And they say, okay, so we're getting something more here. Maybe that was the last straw that broke the camel's back, was the not marrying the Bokor, but it was led up to by a lot of different things, which is what comes out when they sniff around about Clavius as well. Angelina, they go and they tell Angelina, hey, your brother said this, that he was dug up and judged before a tribunal and this and that. And she says it's complete crap. She does say something that's really interesting, though.
Ooh.
She essentially says the only tribunal that my brother ever faced was the graveyard, meaning, you know, he just died. It was just a part of dying.
See, I honestly like that line better than the one you like.
That is fine. But she does say, unless this tribunal took place at night, at which case we would not know of it and we're not supposed to know of it.
I feel like this would be a tribunal that would take place at night.
It, oh, yeah, 100%. That's the point.
Yeah.
Is that she's like, on one hand, she's like, well, that's completely ridiculous. But she is almost like winking to Davis a little bit, being like, unless. But she claims that his stories of being this poor, unfortunate soul are all complete crap.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Now, she claimed that Clavius had always been at odds with his brothers long before their parents' death. He refused to help his family members, and they would always bicker about the finances and this and that. He also apparently had quite the number of children by quite the number of women, none of whom he claimed or provided for, which is a huge social no-no. It actually states, Davis says that he specifically, one of the complaints against him is he did not build a house for every mother of every child that he had, which just shows the social expectation in that case. Now, because he didn't ever marry any of these women, because he never claimed any of the children, he made it to middle age without a whole lot to spend his money on. And so because of this, he had one of the nicest houses in the village, and he always had a lot of money to live large and do this and that. And it ended up with people resenting him, and with people saying he only got this way because he
skimped out on his
his
duties.
Therefore, potentially, just like T-Fan, there could have been that last straw, the bickering with his brothers about land. But at the end of the day,
more of a picture.
Yes, yeah. At the end of the day, he wasn't killed. He wasn't zombified just for that. He was zombified for continued and repeated transgressions against the social order, against the social norm.
And then, of course, you do the punishment in order to keep others from doing the same.
Exactly, just like the death penalty.
Yeah.
But Davis also uncovered that the hospital had requested to do an autopsy on Narcisse, which is totally normal, but his family adamantly denied, even though there was no reason for them to do so.
Huh.
And Davis
interesting.
Points, Davis,
it's like they're in on it.
Yeah, Davis points to this as being the fact that, wait, flip it back, it probably was the family, or at least they knew of it. And of course, just like any story with two sides, it's probably somewhere in the middle that truth resides. Mm-hmm. So, now, Davis had learned a lot about the social implications of zombification and the you know, psychology and idea behind it on a cultural level. But he, again, while that is important to his message and to his reason for being there, that was not his completely total be-all, end-all reason for going to Haiti. That reason, of course, is to find the powder so that it can be synthesized and used. So he focuses his attention back on that. He gives it a few weeks just to make sure, lets the powder come back from analysis, and then when it comes back saying, hey, this is completely and totally worthless, just like you thought, Davis returns to Marcel Pierre's bar, accompanied by Max Beauvoir. Now, he loudly and openly insulted Marcel, calling him a charlatan and a fraud. Davis had told him that he was going to use the powder on one of his enemies in the city, and that it had not worked. Pierre was understandably...
I like that.
Right? I know. it seems legit, for sure. Pierre was understandably outraged at this disruption and at the implication that he was dishonorable in any way. Now, Pierre pulls out the bottle that he had shown Davis at their first meeting, and Davis snatched it out of his hand, and with an impressive sleight of hand, made it appear as though he rubbed the powder onto his own skin, saying that it was nothing more than sawdust, and he could see a physical change on Marcel's face, like, oh god. And Pierre says, you're dead. You are a dead man. I don't know if it's going to be a day or a week or a year, but you are going to die. And Davis puts on this good show of being completely unafraid, and he convinces Pierre that he is completely insane and cannot be intimidated by any man. And Pierre finally just backs down. He's like, okay, all right, crazy, man, you're crazy.
Look at this
and
guy.
He invites Davis. He says, okay, fine, I don't know if part of it is that he truly believes Davis is going to die soon, or if he thinks this one way or the other, this guy's so crazy that it doesn't matter. He says, okay, come back tonight. We'll do this. We'll make this happen.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
And he's like, all right, okay. Fine.
So does he do it?
Oh yeah.
Do they actually get something worthwhile?
Yes. So Pierre finally relents. He invites Davis to return that evening and says it's time to make the poison. And he does. Davis is accompanied by Marcel Pierre and three other individuals. And this group travels across the island to the top of a grassy knoll, the location of which was an unmarked grave. And there they dig up this tiny little coffin. It's only about 3 feet long, and it's the grave of a child.
Oh, man. Yep. Okay.
He says that he very much Indiana Jones this entire thing and does it very straight-faced the entire time he's on the island. This is the only time in his book that he even mentions being, like, afraid. Even watching these people eat hot coals, he was just, this is fascinating. It's from a cultural point of view, but when he sees this and they talk about, like, the coffin splintering open at a certain point and him seeing this dead child, and he just says the horror was insurmountable. I just wanted to scream. But he didn't. He kept it together.
Uh-huh.
And they just take the whole thing, coffin and all, and they put it in a big hemp sack, and they just take it back to the bar. And from there, they then rebury it in one of the corners of the bar, and they keep it there for 3 days. Now, after that time, they dig it up, and they start the actual preparation of the poison. So just with that little detail itself, you can see there is some magical elements here, right? They have to dig it up, then it has to be buried and in the home of a Hungan or a Bokor for 3 days and this and that. And so the ceremony starts with Pierre lighting his arm on fire after covering it with a potion. And then everybody else does the same thing and lights their arms on fire, and yet the fire doesn't burn them. And then they all cover their faces with silk scars and they coat their bodies in some sort of oil in order to protect themselves. Now, from there, Pierre basically, and they're doing this all outside, mm-hmm. Pierre kind of just sits underneath a tree and he kind of yells and says, okay, now you do this, now you do that. And he like sees his neighbors and he's like, hey, how you doing over there? And Davis is just like,
we are
handling the corpse of a child and performing black magic in broad daylight. And this guy is waving to his neighbors.
That's socially acceptable, though. But it's a culture shock.
Yeah, he talks about how he understands that Pierre, while he is described by the BBC, remember they say he's the incarnation of pure evil, he's described this way, he realizes that he's just one more aspect that has to exist in this society. It has to be this way. And therefore, his neighbors, although they are repulsed by what he is doing, and also, of course, because they're afraid of him because he's a sorcerer, they are not going to take any action against him. Now, they crush the skull of the child, and they place it on the ground. Then they place two freshly killed blue lizards next to it. This is followed...
Death.
Yep, this is followed by... Well, this entire thing is death.
That's fair.
They actually, when they tell Jason, no, you're Jason.
I'm Jason.
Hi, Jason.
What do they tell me?
When they tell Davis that they want him to go to Haiti, they refer to it. They say, we want to send you to the frontier of death. So that's pretty hardcore.
That's a tone.
Sets the mood. Yeah. Yes.
All right. Okay. Frontier of death.
Yep. Now, they also have this big dead toad. Which Davis identifies as Bufo marinus, which is a highly toxic specimen.
Ooh.
Yep.
There we go.
Now, the toad had some kind of worm wrapped around its leg, which he was told led to its poison being more potent after death.
Gross.
After this, multiple herbs were introduced into the concoction. one of which he identified was the itching pee, which is not something that I knew existed. And it sounds terrible because apparently if you grab one with your hand, it makes you feel like you have thousands of slivers of glass stuck underneath your skin.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I'm getting psyched out just thinking about it. Yep. And then there are two fish that are introduced as well. The first one Davis could not identify, but the other was obviously a puffer fish. Now,
we're talking about some hardcore toxins then. Yes. We're talking about some painful things going on here.
And we are going to dive into that. I know you've got some things to say about that. But yes, very potent physiological, pharmacological substances are being introduced here. Now, these are all roasted on the grill until they get oily as well. There's a lot of oil in this. There's this oily expulsion that's covering them, essentially. And it's at this point when they start to grind up this human tibia and add that to the mixture. The child's bones were blackened almost to charcoal, and the entire concoction was ground portion by portion in a pestle and mortar. Now, as it was, Marcel Pierre, who, again, was not doing the actual work, he is sitting there, and to the rhythm of the mortar, he begins to sing. And he's keeping this rhythm by the crunching of the bones and the grinding of the stuff. Yeah. And
that's an experience.
Yeah. And he's just sitting there and singing. And then Rachel, the translator, she starts singing as well. Yeah. And Davis just, as it gets more and more and more intense as they go on.
Yeah, the buildup.
Yeah, Davis claims that he's sure that Pierre is about to be mounted by one of the Loa any moment. He realizes that this, in their eyes, is an essential, if not the most essential component of the poison, of the powder itself, is this magic, this singing, this communing with the spirits and calling them down to do harm to your enemies and to strengthen you. And Davis had multiple times found himself to be the fool of a situation by neglecting the magical properties of this culture. He had a difficult time separating his analytical scientific mind from this mystical reality that was playing out in front of him. And this experience, his wonder in it, echoes an earlier experience that he and Rachel had speaking with a young man. The young man was actually Clairvius's cousin, who they come across while chasing down stories of T-Fem and Clairvius Narcisse. Now, the young man had explained how a magical powder was used by the Bokor in order to capture the soul, and Davis responded by asking how this poison was applied. The cousin looked perplexed and explained that there was no poison. Poison kills people, and those killed by it stay in the ground. Clairvius had been risen, and therefore there could be no poison. This was a magical trap, not a pharmacological one. Davis mentions how the preparation of the powder was a completely neutral act in and of itself, but the presence of Marcel Pierre and the ritual that was done turned it to either good or evil.
Wait a second. So you're telling me the fact that you're grinding up a child's bones is neutral?
That's what Davis is telling you.
In the grand scheme of voodoo. Okay.
I still do not know enough to fully understand, but that is what Davis is telling.
I'm going to assume that Davis did his homework.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. He did his homework by living here for months on end.
Exactly. Like, so, Davis is, you know, we can confide in him as being factual and
reliable.
Yeah.
At least in that sense. Yes. Now, once it was done, despite the horrors of robbing a grave and grinding up the bones of a child, Davis was still unable to say whether the act and the powder was good or evil. And he reflects on how multifaceted Pierre is in the context of the end. And like I said, he's a necessary part of this. But after the preparation of the poison, it is then placed back into the coffin with the rest of the child's remains and buried for 3 more days. The preparation of the antidote was a lot more straightforward, Although Marcel explained, he says, basically, Davis says, great, can you make the antidote now? And Marcel says, are you an idiot? Like, what do you mean make the antidote? Of course, we already have the antidote. What happens if you get poisoned? We're gonna make the antidote then? No. You're wearing the antidote. He says, what? And this oil that they've been covered in is the antidote itself. It stops the poison from getting into the skin, but it doesn't counteract it. It doesn't. Oh, okay. And according to Marcel, there is no physical substance that is given to a zombie or to anybody to counteract the poison itself. That, he claims, is completely magical. He knows and he learns what this oil is, but the oil itself really serves, as far as he can tell, no actual purpose. It has nothing that could block a poison from coming in, other than maybe the oil slicks it off of your skin or something like that. But there is no physical reason why it would stop. Yes, exactly. Now, with all of this in mind, Davis heads back home. He goes back to Harvard to have it analyzed. And it's here that he understands what is in the poison, what makes it so potent, and what actually creates the zombie. And we're going to get into all of that right now, right after our break. You can ask anyone. The difference between an amateur and a professional is in the production of the product. Whether it's film, radio, podcast, blog, or any other creative outlet, good stock media is worth its weight in gold. And this holiday season is the best time to up your game. Right now, by going to videoblocks.com/notalone, you will get a year-long subscription to the biggest and best stock media libraries out there for just $149. We're talking audio tracks, video clips, and stock images, all for one low, low price included in the special holiday bundle, all royalty-free forever. Now, this offer is only good through December, so you make sure you head over to videoblocks.com/notalone for the price that you would usually pay to get access to just the stock video library. You'll get access to all of Storyblocks media libraries, sourced from independent content creators. And the creators are getting paid as well, so you can feel good about using this service. It's a win, win, win. If you're ready to take your passion project and turn it into something that can compete with the endless stream of everyone else's passion projects, head over right now to videoblocks.com/notalone. That's videoblocks.com/notalone. You'll be glad you did. Now, the powder, once tested, came back positive for a litany of substances, none of which would truly make that big a difference in a person's chemical physiology besides two major ingredients. Now, the first was bufotoxin. Bufotoxin is extracted from the toad that Davis saw being used to prepare the poison and has one extremely potent component of it known as 5-MeO-DMT, which is a cousin to dimethyltryptamine, or DMT. Which has lately gotten a lot of press from people like Joe Rogan, written about by Terrence McKenna as well. It's been popularized as the spirit molecule.
What does that even mean?
Well, so basically what DMT does, what it is, DMT is what your brain naturally creates little parts of it, little bits of it, and it makes you dream. So...
okay.
When taking DMT, which is also the primary component of ayahuasca, which Davis took in the Amazon at the urging of his mentor, the cool dude, the cool guy, basically it creates an entire experience. You are completely removed from the physical world.
Ah, so it's VR before VR was cool.
Pretty much. It's pretty crazy stuff. It's been used for spiritual communing with the gods. It's what's known as an entheogen.
So you trip out pretty hard.
You trip out extremely hard for about 8 minutes. It's the kind of thing where a good experience is going to be the best thing that ever happens to you, and the bad experience is going to be the worst thing to ever happen to you. And it's been used by Native and South American shamans and all of that. it's a very big, that ayahuasca is a very big part of the sort of religious systems, especially in the rainforest in South America, and, mm-hmm. and it's a coming of age, and it's very crucial to their belief system. But whereas that's what straight DMT does, 5-MeO-DMT works on a more physiological level.
Okay.
It can cause a little bit of hallucination, but interesting enough, it does things more to the body. Things like a feeling of being unable to breathe. Now, the people who report this and the people who have studied people reporting this say that there is actually no issue with the breathing. The individual is breathing just fine, mm-hmm. automatically, like their body is going to, and yet they are convinced that they are not breathing anymore.
So it affects their sensories.
It affects their sensories. Sensories.
Sensories.
Sensories.
There you go.
Now, the individual may also feel changes in bodily form.
Ooh.
Their body may feel physically different, and changes in gravity. So you have, again, this idea of Clairvius floating above his grave when he's layered in.
Right.
So gravity, bodily form, and the fact that he felt like he was no longer breathing, and for the most part, other people also believed he was no longer breathing. These things line up with this Bufo toxin very well. It also will cause the face and the lips to go purple or go blue as if there is a lack of oxygen.
Right.
And it will cause a prickling sensation in the face, which is something that Clairvius reported right before he quote-unquote died. This substance, as well as its cousin straight DMT, 5-MeO-DMT, has been well known to South and Central American shamans for thousands of years. When used properly, it can create a religious experience, but it's something that they would have a knowledge of in this region. Now, the other substance found, and probably the most important one in the report, was tetrodotoxin, which is one of the strongest nerve toxins known to modern science and is found commonly in the pufferfish, which...
Oh, yeah.
which, of course, was observed as a part of the preparation of the poison by Davis. Now, tetrodotoxin was popularized primarily in the James Bond novel From Russia with Love, wherein Bond is pricked with a knife and finds himself completely paralyzed and unable to move moments later. The poison itself is between 10 and 12,000 times more deadly than cyanide and has no known antidote.
So that plays perfectly with the fact that we have to use essentially a barrier, a protective shield against the substance as your antidote.
If it gets into you to begin with, you're
kind of screwed.
Done.
Yeah.
You're
not having a fun time.
No, it's
and
not good.
From what I've seen, the zombie powder is just a topical application onto the skin, which poisons, that's how they work. They get absorbed through skin or ingestion to really do their effects. And from the amount that it would need from this pufferfish toxin, it is not a lot.
25 milligrams will kill an adult human.
That's terrifying.
One pufferfish has enough in it to kill 30 adult human beings.
So we're like a full bus.
Yes, you with could one kill pufferfish. A bus full of people with this.
Wow.
It's like that meme.
That's
what
impressive.
Would win, a bus full of people or one
pufferfish.
Puffy boy?
My money's on the puffer.
There we go.
So what's awesome, though, is that, of course, we know, like, Japanese culture, they do eat pufferfish, and so does the Haitian population as well.
And
pufferfish is actually a food source.
And it gives you a little bit of high.
Yeah.
You get a little high.
This is the best part. You get a very slight numbness and a sense of euphoria if it's cooked properly.
Can you imagine being that guy who's like, I'm going to eat it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to try it.
I've got my affairs in order just in case something was to go poor.
I read because so in Japan, legally to prepare it, which you can, right? It's not like this back alley thing, which I feel like
it's not like, I don't know, making moonshine here in the States.
Right.
It's like
it's
a legit
bootlegging
thing.
But you have to be certified. Essentially, and
right.
The final test for certification
is you have to eat your
have to eat your cooked Pufferfish. Yeah.
Oh, man. Now that needs to be a part of MasterChef.
Yeah.
Seriously.
That'd be good.
Today we're cooking pufferfish. Everyone dies.
I also found that dolphins who are the worst.
Oh, yeah. They get high off
them. They get high
off. It's great.
They'll like,
but how do they not like get overdosed?
Well, they just gently chew on them.
Yeah. And then pass.
We're doing it. Exactly. Pass puff, puff, pass.
Oh, man.
What else?
Okay.
So in Japan, you have people who overdose from this, not infrequently. And it's actually to the point you were mentioning it last week, that there are some different protocols when it comes to somebody who may have died of pufferfish toxin, right? Because it lowers the heart rate and it puts one into this death-like coma. To the point where I think you have to wait a period of days.
Yeah, it's 5 days.
Yeah, you have to wait 5 days.
You essentially just let your buddy hang out against the wall for 5 days. And after that time period, it's safe to say, all right, time to put him in the ground.
Dead.
Yeah.
So it works and it acts completely and totally like what is being described.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's perfect.
It's a death-like state. And there's some little... People have some little problems that we'll get into with it.
What?
But no, we'll talk about it. It does these two components, the two most potent as well, they do exactly what is being described. They match up Narcisse's story pretty dang well. Now
we've got essentially the understanding of what kills
mm-hmm.
our soon-to-be zombie, but what keeps them a zombie?
So the actual drug, which... Davis ends up making, I think, 3 trips to Haiti. So all of this that we've done so far has come from the first half of his book. I didn't have time to read all of it,
yeah.
Unfortunately. But you should. I'm going to do it when I have more time. It's fascinating. On a return trip, he does get this paste. And the paste is something like sugar and sweet potato and poison.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
So... It's the poison is known as, it's a strain of the Datura plant, which is known as Jimson weed or the zombie cucumber.
There we go. That's a little bit more descriptive.
This is like the local name for it.
Yeah.
The zombie cucumber. It's also known as Hell's Bells. It's known as the Devil's Cucumber. It's known as Devil's Poison, Devil's Snare.
It's another reason why I don't like cucumbers.
Right?
No, thank you.
Now,
be a zombie one.
Datura, D-A-T-U-R-A, I think I'm saying that. Datura is a nasty, particularly nasty drug. The entire point of it, the reason that people take it recreationally, and for some reason they do, is to induce a state of delirium.
What? Yeah. That sounds like fun to you?
Right? The literal point of this drug is to make it so that you do not have the ability to tell what is real and what is not. It can have minor hallucinogenic effects, but it is mainly, what is it? So you've got a delirium.
It plays with your perception.
Well, I read the word. There's like a hallucinogenic, and then I think this is referred to as a deliriant. And it will cause this sort of dreamlike quality. I watched a few different videos of people taking it. And
oh, man.
First off, people go crazy, like psycho screaming, yelling, and then just quiet again and then screaming again. And people who come out of it say like that was the worst experience
that's
of my
terrifying
life. I felt like I was in hell. And one dose of it can last between 24 hours and 2 weeks.
What?
Yeah, it is something.
See, that's again not the kind of commitment I can
no.
do.
Jason's
got way
Jason's
too much
casual drug user.
I
no
can't
one
commit
here is,
that
no
much
one
time
here is using drugs. Let's just make sure everybody knows that. No one here has taken Datura, but it is scary. I mean, it sounds terrifying. People say, I felt like I died and I went to hell. I was trapped in a nightmare. And it creates that time distortion.
So it's a bad trip.
It's a bad
most
trip.
Most of the time.
99% of the time. But again, even this drug, even this substance has been used as what's known as an entheogen. So... An entheogen is a what?
What's an entheogen?
Why are you making that face?
I'm waiting. Tell me what it is.
An entheogen, which literally translates to creating God within, are these spiritual drugs, are these spiritual substances, DMT, Datura, ayahuasca, peyote, these things that people use to communicate on a spiritual level and use in religious ceremony and practice.
And all those drugs essentially have one solid theme in common, where they warp your perception of your reality.
Right.
In some way or another.
Yeah. And so even this Datura has been used. It was specifically used by the ancient inhabitants of Central and South California in their religious practices, which just goes to show that, like, with these things, there's a right way to do them and a wrong way to do them.
And this plant isn't just native to Haiti. It's
all over. It's called Jimson weed. Jimson is short for Jamestown, because it was found in Jamestown, which, of course, is the first settlement, the first white settlement in America.
Yeah. So it's just American.
Yeah, it's all over the place.
This is a plant that you can find almost anywhere. Mm-hmm.
And Davis found this plant on his last day in Haiti. He had an idea that that's what it was, but he found a field of it.
Oh, good.
And it was in an area that was reportedly linked to a secret society that owned this field. So
yeah, was it right by like a cove where pufferfish, like... You could just raise their
breed. Everything you
it's
need.
A one-stop
right
stop shop is what I'm zombies. Getting at.
Yeah, so he had a good idea of that from the start. That's what it came out to be. But interestingly enough, Davis also theorizes that the Datura could create some sort of interaction that, while it did put them in the zombie-like state, it may be what arrests the neurotoxin, the tetrodotoxin, from actually killing the individual. So even though it is completely unintentional, like Marcel Pierre said, there is
it has almost like a canceling, balancing out effect.
Exactly.
Weird. Okay.
As far as he knows, Marcel Pierre knows, there is no substance that brings them back to life, but it may ironically be this Datura, which of course also puts them in that state of the walking dead, mm-hmm. of being alive and yet not there. Because Pierre says that is the first thing that happens, is they start him off on this paste. And then they take it at least once a day, every day, for the rest of their lives. I mean, we got to remember that in traditional Haitian voodoo...
Right, that keeps them under the voodoo spell, mm-hmm. essentially.
The people that we've talked about, Narcisse and Tifem, even Tifem has been the lucky ones and have gotten away. Typically, this is the rest of your life. Forever. Mm-hmm. Ooh, that scares me a little. That scares me a lot. But this is it. I mean, he found the poison, he found the antidote in its own way, he found the counteraction. The science is all there. Each one of these individual components does exactly what it needs to do to create a zombie. But at the end of the day, although Davis's research on the zombification of Clairvius Narcisse won him his doctorate and catapulted him to international fame, he has been questioned pretty substantially by a good number of other academics.
Mainly ethnically, correct? Because he took part in the ceremonies and the preparation and the desecration.
The first and biggest thing is... The desecration. You dug up a child's grave and crushed its skull and used it to make powder. That's obviously not a great thing. But it is. And to that I say, well, what else are we supposed to do?
You know, like, yeah, I hate like to that's, say that's, it, but... that's the price of admission. Like, if you're trying to figure out what this powder is, then, well, you're here for the long haul, good and bad. Mm-hmm. Even if you know it's not going to make an actual difference with what you're actually producing.
Right. And you have to say... Now, he does mention, he does have this crisis while they're preparing the powder, and he talks about how, basically, he says, I am the reason that we did this, right? So, Marcel Pierre eventually would have dug up somebody's grave, and eventually would have made the powder again, and this and that, but the reason that this child is out of the ground right now is because of me. And he does have that moral self-awareness. He's not... And I think that would be important to have. I mean, yes, I agree with you. It's the price of admission. It's what you have to do. But you also don't want to, you know, lose your soul in it, lose your sense of right and wrong. But I do agree that that is a terrible argument. Like, the fact that you do this, it makes your findings invalid. Unfortunately, not. It if anything, it makes them more valid. The fact that you actually had to go through and do this, you saw it prepared, as opposed to just taking the bottle from him in the first place.
Yeah, and then just getting it analyzed.
Mm-hmm. They also say it was unethical of him to bring it into the United States when it could have been a poison and could have, if something went wrong, it could have affected a lot of people again. It's kind of what you got to do, I guess. I mean, if it had been...
Right, I mean, I don't think he really had the equipment or do complete analysis probably in Haiti.
No. And so it's
or
it's
authorization just part of even it. To do that.
Yeah.
So he's an entobotanist, right?
Entobotanist, yeah.
So is that like an architectural botanist? Not architectural. Archaeological? Yes,
no,
thank you.
Kind of. It's more of an anthropological.
Okay.
Yeah. So it is an ethnobotanist is someone who studies the specifically the plants and the flora of a particular region mm-hmm. and how that interacts with the culture of the region itself.
Yeah, this is perfect. This is right up his alley.
Yeah, he's the best man for the job.
I feel like that's really weird for him to get so much discredit from his other peers when this is to the T what his field is.
Well, and you just got to remember that this is what it is. When you look at things like this, things outside of the social norm, things like paranormal in its own way, you know, of course, there is the magical aspect in all of this, but you can't explain it all pharmacologically. You can't explain it all on a physical level. And yet, even with all of this, and we'll kind of get into it here, but people still say, well, that's absurd. There are no such things as zombies, and therefore you must be wrong. 100%. You've got to be wrong. And
I think it comes down to some that person's individual description of what a zombie is then.
True.
Because, again, what a zombie is has been warped through culture.
True.
Through our own pop culture.
Even to be the most basic that we can be, a zombie, even without the powder and this and that, a zombie still exists in the fact that there were, and unfortunately most likely still are, individuals who have cognitive disabilities who are put to work on plantations against their will. That would still be a zombie, even if there was no magic or powder about it.
Yeah, or me before coffee.
Right.
It's the same exact
yes,
kind of thing.
Exactly the same thing, Jason.
We're not the
Thank
same.
You.
We're not, I am literally just a living corpse before coffee. And after coffee, I'm resembling a human.
Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome.
So, yeah. And people just straight up say, well, no, that's not true. That's not how it is. So it is the perfect, I say perfect example of the fact that there are some people who straight up, well, I may want to believe, and that may definitely affect my worldview and how I interact with things. There are people who do not want to believe, and therefore they will shut themselves out of these situations. The same thing with like, they say that his whole premise is flawed in this. They say that, well, you're assuming that the man who came back into the village marketplace was Clavius Narcisse and not just somebody else. Or alternatively, you're saying that the man who went into the ground was Clavius Narcisse and not just somebody else. But the man who went into the ground was positively identified by his kin, by his family, and the man who came back answered questions about his family and about himself that could not and would not have been known to anybody else.
Right.
So
he has pretty good authority that this man is who he thinks he
yes,
is.
Yes, it definitely seems to be. But even beyond that, his physical conclusions have been questioned as well. People claim that the tetrodotoxin poisoning, they say, well, this happens all the time, right? There's in Japan, it's something like, I think, 8 to 12 people every year.
Okay, man, you stop telling me those numbers because I still want to try pufferfish.
Well, please don't. 8 to 12 people every year die of fugu. They call it fugu, of this fugu fish. And the people say, well, the people who wake up in Japan don't become zombies. It's like, yeah, no. Crap,
yeah, it's
dude.
Because zombies aren't a part of their culture.
Yeah, it's cultural. Davis says that even if only once a zombie has actually been produced, that is more than enough to cemented in the minds of the people. Mm-hmm. And then from there going forward, anytime something like this was to happen, anytime a person was buried alive, whether it was due to fugu fish or not, that idea would be in their mind.
Right. Anytime it's the power of that belief that is what really creates the zombie mm-hmm. itself.
Whenever there's a sickness, whenever there's a miraculous recovery, any of that would all be covered under the zombie. So the other thing, which again, to that argument, I say that's crap. The other argument, which can hold, I guess, a little bit more water, is the fact that when tested on like lab rats and stuff like that, the poison did not kill them. It did not put them specifically into this little coma. But
so then the exact poison that he got wasn't powerful enough. Like there is just too minute yes. of these. It's instead of being like a potent amount of toxicity that we expect, it's more like they're very trace amounts.
Exactly. And that's the argument. They say, well, there's no way that the Bokor would be able to provide the correct amount to zombify an individual consistently. And to that I say, they don't need to. They can, again, just like Davis says, if it happens
once,
just
putting
right,
the powder on your arm, you will start to assume that you're mm-hmm. dying.
And if they do too much and they die, they die. And if they do too little and they don't, they don't. It is only this specific, even if it's just one out of every 50 times this happens, this specific time that it takes place. And the other thing is that because this is a systematic process, a systematic selection of people, mm-hmm. usually done on a community level, and in theory done in the dark by secret tribunals and all this, they're going to know the victim very well. They're going to know about how much the victim weighs, what they look like.
They're
going
to be able to do the science portion of it.
Exactly. Yeah. And the tetrodotoxin I looked up, there is no genetic variance in tetrodotoxin. There are not people who are more or less
susceptible.
Yeah.
Okay. Tolerance to it.
In theory, it should be a pretty standard equation.
Yeah.
In order to make it work.
Get the proper amounts.
Exactly. So, I mean, I feel ya. Everybody who has issues with it, I feel
ya. I mean, his main goal when he was going down there was to find what part of the powder was essentially creating the zombie, right? So, I mean,
right.
And he's found that.
Yeah.
Essentially, we found what chemicals are actually in play to really put the person in that kind of dead state and mm-hmm. then be able to maybe survive that.
Mm-hmm. It's
just the quantities that were not quite correct.
Yeah, the science is there. The actual...
And we're talking about a ritual. I mean, it's not like we're putting these guys in beakers and
right.
being able to specifically measure the toxicities.
Right, exactly. And it's... what was it?
So there's variance between the powders.
Oh, yeah, there's totally variance between the powders, which is fine, and there needs to be based on weight and stuff like that.
It's the combination of the powder and the belief of the culture that creates the zombie.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a tour. It's two parts.
Exactly. It's
physical and mental.
Mm-hmm. And without either one of them, you don't become a zombie. You know, it's interesting.
Just have a really bad trip.
Yeah, seriously. Each component is there. The potential is there. Nobody came back and said. Right. Nobody came back and said, well, you don't actually, there is no tetrodotoxin in this. There is no bufotoxin in this. The components have never not been there. Right. It's just how they've reacted in laboratory settings.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, we're not scientists.
Yeah, we're not
toxicologists. But I feel like it makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah, it does. I think personally that it was just a little bit too much scrutiny and put under pressure.
Mm-hmm. But to be fair, when you're looking at a doctoral candidate and a thesis, it needs to be scrutinized, right?
Oh, of course.
So, but I do feel like, and to be fair, on the other side of things, Davis, when he presented his thesis and in this book and stuff, it doesn't talk about how the lab rats were ineffective
and
stuff like that.
It's
he's
not
withholding
like...
negative data.
And he's also, he's not going for like a pharmaceutical degree.
No.
Like it is literally culture and
plants.
Substance
yeah.
combined.
Plant culture.
Yeah, dude.
Yes.
Like so makes a lot more sense that his professor wanted him to go encouraged him, to say the least.
Cool guy, professor. So, end of the day, I think I've made it very clear what I believe. What do you think?
Oh, man, dude. I think it is the right combinations of poisons, of course. But mm-hmm. I think it has a lot to do with one's own belief and a cultural belief. And that's, I knew that you had already last week looked into a bit of the poisons and what kind mm-hmm. of effects that has. So this week, I actually was trying to figure out, I still don't understand firewalking. So I wanted to find out that's more about fine. That. But I also watched a video of a man eat coals as well. And I think one of the big plays that actually helps with that, and I didn't know this, but hardwoods are really good insulators. They're bad at transferring heat. And the clip that I saw of a man eating coals, essentially just a burning piece of wood that was charred instead, he was actually still holding the piece of wood in his hands as it was black and charred and stuff as he was chewing on it. And that's a dead giveaway to me that that must have been a hardwood, because otherwise the wood would eventually just transfer too much heat to his hands and he would burn and he'd drop it. So well, maybe it's a combination of the hardwoods. It's the right type of wood to eat.
That's
is
fair.
The big thing.
I guess that's
and
fair.
And same thing with firewalking, is it has to be a hardwood. And then after that, you also let it sit for a while it's been burned and charred.
Uh-huh.
What that does is essentially allow all the moisture to escape.
Okay.
Because the water in the wood itself, that is essentially the quickest way to transfer heat.
Okay.
So that plays in a role. But otherwise, I also took a look at just like how belief works, not only in a religious aspect of it, because religion has been probably one of the biggest things that have helped man evolve and stay together, because it brings a sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
A sense of oneself and essentially a kind of rules book in order to govern a community, a social order
mm-hmm.
to it. But from there, I mean, simply just believing in like your mental belief of yourself plays a huge role as well. It's not just simply, do I believe in this? Do I believe that I can go do something? And that all can be shaped just by wording, which mm-hmm. is what's interesting, is that like if I tell you, Sam, you're really good at making notes.
Thanks, dude.
See, that kind of affirmation versus, Sam, I can see you tried very hard on these notes.
What's that supposed to mean,
using,
dude?
Using the word
I'll fight
try.
You.
So I understand where you're getting a little aggressive, but using the word try versus confirming that you are talented.
Right.
Usually helps the individual become more... aggressive towards harder tasks.
Okay.
So more enthusiastic versus saying, hey, I'm perfectly fine where I'm at. I'm going to go back to Star Wars for a moment, because it's like Anakin just being really, really talented and gifted versus Obi-Wan, which he tried and worked very, very hard. Once he gets to episode 3, Obi-Wan bests him.
Right.
And it's that kind of...
Hard work always beats natural talent.
Exactly.
Okay.
So... being able to word.
I don't know about always, though.
Yeah, it helps a great
sometimes,
deal.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
Most of the time, yeah.
But even just the way that you speak and the way that the way that you think about yourself vastly changes how well you learn and how well you can improve yourself. So it's belief goes from much more than just a social and a cultural thing, but to a personal level, and it affects almost everything that you do.
Okay. All right.
That was a weird tangent that I went on.
That
Sorry.
Was strange. I kind of dozed out in the middle and came back, and I was like, "Wait, what's going on?"
I know,
here?
Right? What am I talking about again?
That's fine.
But I think
Go ahead.
I'm gonna wrap it all the way back around. But okay. I think you know it's the amount of belief that this culture has towards voodoo and towards zombification method.
Yes.
That really, really cements it and creates it. The zombie is a cultural thing. It's not a physical thing.
Right. Agreed.
Cool. I just went a roundabout way to say that.
I love it. So at the end of the day, was Clavius Narcisse buried and raised from the dead?
Dead? No.
Right. Even within the cultural context, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is he telling the truth?
I think he truly believes it from what he experienced himself.
Okay.
From his current knowledge of how the world works.
Okay. So that was a very politician answer.
Thank you.
Let's just try this again. Was he poisoned?
Oh, yes.
And then taken out of his grave?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Yeah, me too. I agree completely. It is very hard to say from there, of course. Was he actually physically taken and made to be a slave on this plantation and this and that? That's the stuff that we cannot know, because the only person
we can't verify it
to tell it is Narcisse. Whereas the other things, we do have options. And at that point, you just say, well, looking at then the peripheral cultural, not even just the cultural beliefs, but what has been documented by people like Seaward on his Magic Island, the Magic Island book, as well as there's another individual that we really didn't mention. It's Zora Neale Hurston, who went down to Haiti back in the 30s and wrote a book called Tell My Horse, based on the folklore and traditions there. And she also confirmed seeing these zombies working in the fields.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, you just have to say, well, while we don't know for sure that that's what happened to Narcisse, if we do believe that he was in the ground and then taken out of the ground, it makes sense, right? That's
right.
What the zombie is.
It's
is
a
meant
you
to
can
do.
Take a logical step towards that.
Exactly. So, I mean, with all of that, I would say, and then based on how he did live his life, as we know from his family, it makes sense that he'd skip town for a few years.
Yeah.
Wait for it to die down and all that. The idea of him being taken to the jail for his own safekeeping, that definitely happened. According to records and all of that. It is the most compelling case of the paranormal I've probably ever seen.
Is it paranormal though?
When it comes down
that's
to
the,
it, though, that's
question.
What I was about
yeah.
to say. When it comes down to it, it is just normal in its own way.
I think it's so anthropological.
Anthropological. So it is still, though, very interesting.
It's wonderful.
I have been doing so much between Charles Walton and this and all that. I'm just really trying to learn more about magic, which, quick plug, I found a podcast called The History of Witchcraft.
Ooh.
Yeah, and it starts with, like, the Malleus Maleficarum and then goes from there. So
they talk about beer?
I don't know. Okay. I haven't really gotten – I listened to, like, 30 minutes of it because I've been busy.
Yeah.
But – it's pretty neat. Everyone should go listen to that. It's pretty good so far. But I just really enjoy, because the one thing that I'm learning the more I learn about magical practice and thought and all that is that it is essentially a lot of times, not to offend any of our listeners or anything like that, essentially it comes down to fake it till you make it and the power of belief. And it's just interesting to be able to say that, again, Davis this entire time is being told the powder does not make the zombie. The Bokor, the man, makes the zombie. And they're not wrong. I mean, that's what we've seen, is that they are not wrong. It is so interesting to be able to say that and to see that. So I honestly wasn't sure how well this series was going to do. I didn't know how much there was going to be to talk about it. I didn't know if we'd do like one 45-minute episode. But then as I got into it more and more...
Oh, it's fascinating.
Yeah, it is the best rabbit hole I've probably ever been down my entire life.
Oh,
between and entheogens and voodoo and zombies, it's been awesome. So, and I've had a lot of people tell me as well that this is one of their favorite series we've done. So, yeah, I dig it. I think that he was a zombie.
You dig it?
100%. Terrible.
Hey, you said it, not me.
I did. So, yeah.
I love
down
it, man.
With it.
I love it.
Cool.
What other business do we got to get down
to? What else
to?
Do we got? So let me do this. So we have two new reviews this week. One is from Happy Housekeeper. Thank you, Happy Housekeeper. And the other is from Dark Forest.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Those are two very different extremes.
They are. We're going to read Dark Forest. It says, As a big fan of paranormal podcasts, I subscribed to all that I could find. After a few months of listening, it became apparent that most weren't worth the time or space on my phone. That being said, Not Alone stands out as one of the best out there. I could easily place it in my top three favorites. The hosts are great, the overall sound is professional, and the subjects are always interesting. Give it a listen, you won't be disappointed. And thanks, Not Alone, for making my commute more enjoyable each week.
Oh man, that's awesome.
That
Dark
is
Forest.
Nice.
That's
really,
wonderful.
When people say that we're like Thank their goodness, favorite, we're... it or one
or
of their
we
favorites,
sound professional.
Yeah, it, or that we sound professional. It's so nice.
Like, oh, thank God. Happy. We're doing something right.
And then we'd also like to thank, we got one new patron this week. So we'd like to thank Rocco Vanderboog.
Thank Rocky. You. Rocco nice.
Boog. Woo. Boog. That's a good name.
I love
I like
it.
That name.
Where does that originate from if you hear this?
Yeah,
let me
tell
know.
Us. Let us know.
I want to know.
Yeah. And beyond that, guys, you can go to patreon.com/notalone to donate to your favorite podcast. Because we are somebody's favorite podcast, which just makes me want to cry. To donate to your favorite podcast, you can do it for $1, $3, or $5 a month. You can also go to iTunes, leave us a 5-star rating and review. That'd be super dope of you. We love that. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Not Alone Pod, and Jason is at Mighty Moit.
Yeah.
You want to spell that for the people?
It's mighty and MOIT
Mighty Moit. How many followers are you up to?
I don't know.
Let's see.
It scares me.
Yeah. Have you?
I haven't used it at all.
I've
used it a little bit. I don't know. I don't like. I don't know. It feels very aggressive to me.
Aggressive. Jason is up to 32 followers.
Oh man, that's pretty watch good. Out, everyone. So that is a 32.
Yep,
32. 320% increase.
Yeah. So if you're on Twitter and you want to talk to Jason, oh, Mighty Moit.
3,000% increase.
Wow.
What am I talking about? I don't know. Math.
Wouldn't it be? Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Because yes, I had zero. Yeah.
But that's the thing about zero. 3,000% of zero is zero.
I'm just assuming it's
we
one.
We have to assume
I had
you
one.
Have one. Yeah. Okay. But yeah. You didn't. No. You literally had zero.
It was fine.
Beautiful. You can find us on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast. You can find us on Instagram at Not Alone Podcast. You can go to notalonepodcast.com to find more information about this and all of our other episodes. That's where we link to our sources, the books used, the articles used. So if you are interested in any of this, head over there for more information. Make sure to check out our sponsor, Video Blocks, for some great, great stock media. To get that going, that's a really great way of, even if you just sign up for the free trial, that is a great way of helping the show. What else? Anything else?
I think we got it, Sam.
I think we got it. Jason is going to go on vacation.
Yes.
So he may or may not be here next week. We are trying to figure it out.
We're working on it.
I will be here, and our good friend Rob Christofferson will be here. We'll be talking with him.
Oh, Rob.
Especially about all of the alien, well, not alien. UFO news that has come out the last week. But yeah, we'll see about that. So if nothing else, Jason, why don't you tell the people happy holidays, just in case?
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. I don't know.
Just in case. Yeah, that's good enough for me. We'll just in case I'm not here.
Yep. And then who did it last week? You did it.
I did, didn't I? Okay. Yeah.
Remember, whether you find yourself 6 feet under the ground, with no air and no hope, or you find yourself sitting around the Christmas table, you are
not alone.